The voice almost sing-song, crooning, "You need to brush 100 strokes a night, baby. You know that."
"Are you for real? Get your hands, ow!"
Rebecca howls as the brush snags, sending fiery pain to the roots.
"Be still!"
A hand, no longer gentle, clamps down over her scalp.
"Did you forget that if you squirm around, it makes it harder for me?" "Harder for you?"
Fury boils in Rebecca's blood.
"You're out of your mind. Seriously. You're insane, and I'm not... Ow!"
"Sorry, baby, but it's your own fault. You haven't been brushing it, have you?"
"Not at all. I can tell." "Baby? I am not your baby!"
Rebecca bites out, jaw clenched.
"Don't say that. Sit still."
Tears sting Rebecca's eyes as the brush moves through her hair again, snags again.
"Stop it! I'm not your baby, you crazy f-"
"Shut up!"
"You shut up and get your hands off me!"
The brush pivots abruptly, and Rebecca's nerves explode in agony as a thick clump of hair rips from her scalp at the roots. A primal howl escapes Rebecca. She can only hope someone, somewhere, will hear it and come to her rescue.
"Look what you made me do. You're going to have a bald spot now. Are you happy?"
Rebecca instinctively clamps her mouth shut. Summoning every ounce of self-control she has, she manages to still her body, manages to say softly,
"I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done it."
"No, you shouldn't have. But you're the one who has to live with this unsightly bald spot, not me."
"Unsightly bald spot?
What about the unsightly gaping wound in the middle of my damn forehead?" Rebecca wants to screech. But she forces herself to stay quiet, stay still. The brush is moving through her hair again.
"There, now, isn't that better? If you just..."
The brush yanks at a snarl, and Rebecca bites her lower lip to keep from crying out.
"If you just would have listened to me in the first place, none of this, none of it, would have happened. You'd be in the house opening your Christmas presents like a good girl."
"Christmas presents?" Rebecca echoes, then catches herself. "They're all wrapped and waiting under the tree for you. And I baked gingerbread, just like I promised you."
"Tree? Gingerbread? Good Lord, this freak is even more insane than I thought."
"Thank you," Rebecca makes herself say politely.
"That was kind of you."
Gag.
"Well, I'm nothing if not kind. You know that. Even when you don't deserve it. But if you're a good girl and you behave yourself from now on, maybe you'll get presents and gingerbread after all."
"Yeah, right. Or maybe you'll slit my throat when I'm not looking, you freak."
"What do you say, baby? Can you be a good little girl?"
"Yes,"
Rebecca says meekly.
"I can be a good little girl."
Then she dips her head forward abruptly and slams it back as hard as she can. Her skull meets its target with a satisfying thud and explodes in blinding, nauseating pain. Dimly aware of her tormentor's outraged bellow, Rebecca falls to her hands and knees on the dirt floor.
"You little bitch!"
Rebecca feels herself reeling, spinning. She begins to crawl toward the ladder, feels cold, hard hands grabbing her ankles. Her knees are yanked from under her, and she's down on her stomach, being dragged backward.
"I'm sorry,"
she screams, desperate.
"I didn't mean it. It was an accident. I didn't mean to hurt you."
The dragging pauses.
"You didn't?" "No, I told you. It was an accident."
Rebecca's head throbs, and her body is trembling so violently she can literally feel her bones rattling.
"Really?
It was an accident?"
"No, I wanted to kill you. If I could have, I would have."
"Yes,"
Rebecca manages to say through the pain.
"Really?"
"All right then, baby. Accidents happen. Now let's fix your hair, because you really look hideously ugly right now, you know that? Why on earth did you dye your hair that god-awful shade of orange?"
Before she can stop herself, Rebecca jerks her leg up in a swift, hard kick. It makes contact, but she knows that she just made a terrible mistake.
You little!
Her assailant is upon her. Rebecca fights back, clawing, biting, growling. She manages to wrench herself free and struggles to regain control, but the pain in her skull is too intense. Hot, acid vomit rushes up her throat now, choking her as she futilely struggles toward the ladder. She feels a rush of movement behind her. She forces her eyes open, spins her head just in time to see the brand coming at her again. This time, though, it isn't red hot, just hard and heavy. And the brand comes down with a mighty force into Rebecca's forehead, obliterating the very message inflicted there just hours ago. Mine. Chapter 13. The Atlantic is a little rough, rocking the small fishing boat as the engine cuts to an idling putter. 10 miles out at sea, the coastal lights long since vanished in the pre-dawn haze. Nothing out here but the incessant waves sparkling in the early morning light, the smell of sticky salt air, the screech of an arcing seagull high overhead.
"Planning on chumming?"
asked a middle-aged fisherman back at the dock. He came out of nowhere to eye the sealed 5-gallon buckets as they were being loaded onto the boat. He seemed satisfied with the casual affirmative reply.
"Well, good luck out there. The fish are biting today."
With a friendly wave, he strolled toward his pickup truck parked nearby, unaware that its vanity license plate had just been memorized. New Jersey, J. Murph 2, with a black plate holder from a Beach Haven dealership. J. Murph 2's future, his life, is now hanging in the balance. Just like Eddie Casalino, he'd noticed too much, said too much. Something will have to be done about his interference. Later, though. For now, the important thing is chumming. The internet contained specific instructions for that method of baiting. The first step, hang a milk crate off the back of the boat, low enough so that its base just touches the water. That's the easy part. Time for the hard part, prying the cover off the first bucket while trying not to pass out from the overwhelming smell. A clean bandana tied tightly over both mouth and nostrils doesn't come close to blocking it out. Steady there. Don't get sick, faint, fall overboard. Just focus on what you have to do, and do it fast. The contents of the bucket hit the crate with a sickening, sloshing thud. Salt water laps over the slimy, bloody heap of eviscerated flesh, shattered bone, oozing entrails, washing it into the sea. It shouldn't be long now. Yawn. The sleepless night's effects are starting to take hold. So is thirst. A few bottles of water on the boat would have been a good idea. That, and maybe some nice loud music, so I don't drift right off to sleep out here. Then again, one would be hard-pressed to find a fitting soundtrack for these particular circumstances. Speculation in that regard is an amusing diversion until something breaks the surface of the water a good distance away, then disappears. Was that? Oh, yes. It sure was. The dorsal fin crests again, barreling this way. With it, the most appropriate background music of all springs to mind. The theme from Jaws, of course. That lackadaisical thought is quickly discarded. This is no laughing matter. The contents of the second bucket are quickly poured directly into the water, the third as well, and then the last. Fascinating and a little frightening to watch the frothy feeding frenzy that ensues. In no time, the boat will be headed back to shore, and this unpleasant little episode will draw to a close. How could you have made such a careless mistake? As the creatures from the ocean's cold depths dispose of Rebecca Pearson's unrecognizable remains, the most menacing predator of all watches through narrowed eyes from the boat, knowing the hunt must begin again. Today, even. There's no time to waste. She's somewhere on that island, and you're going to find her. Cam awakens, bathed in sweat, to bright sunlight and a ringing telephone. What the? What time? Past 12. P.M. The standing fan at the foot of the bed creaks as it pans across her body, and the phone rings again. She should answer it. Sitting up, she swings her bare feet around to the floor and rubs her eyes. She hasn't slept this late since college, probably, Cam decides as she fumbles around for her cell phone. Noon, yet she didn't even get a full 8 hours. It was after midnight when she got back from the police station. She sat up for a while, poring over the notebooks she'd left on the coffee table, remembering every detail about some visions, having forgotten some others even existed, even with the notes. They all started to blend together after a while. Girl, about 16, dark hair, green eyes, in bathing suit. Kid, college-aged, scruffy beard, Teva sandals. Boy, in jeans and gray Nike t-shirt, on skateboard. She found herself wondering what happened to them. She reminded herself that she already knew. In the latest notebook, she added Leah's name to the first page. Then she sat reading about her and the other girl, willing more information to come to her, praying for another vision. Nothing happened. Maybe she was just too tired. Finally, she put the notebooks aside and went to bed. It wasn't until she sank back against the pillows that she realized something. Not only had she just survived one of the most stressful nights of her life without a drop of booze, but she hadn't even craved it. Caught up in the unfolding drama, she never once considered numbing her emotions with liquor. A milestone. That's what it was. A turning point in her ongoing battle. Kathy told her there would be many of those along the way. She warned Cam not to let her guard down, get too confident. The second you decide you've won the war, Kathy said ominously, you're asking for trouble. Cam had a terrible time falling asleep. She was still lying awake when the sun came up, still on edge, still thinking of that red-headed girl, feeling as though it's too late for her, just like all the others. She might be wrong. She desperately hopes she is. But even now, in the light of day, the aura of doom persists. The phone stops ringing just as she finds it in the pocket of the shorts she had on yesterday. That's fine with Cam. She doesn't feel like talking to anyone anyway. And her bladder is painfully full. Then she remembers. Tess. If Tess was calling. But she wasn't. The caller ID reveals a local number. Fine. Whoever it was will leave a message. Cam hurries into the bathroom, the earlier part of last night, at the police station, rushing back at her. Detective Barraquette said he'd be in touch, took her number, gave her his card. Lucinda didn't volunteer her contact information, and Cam didn't ask. As much as Cam would have loved to get together again, talk, compare notes, she was too shy, in the end, to extend an invitation. No wonder you haven't made a new friend in so long. Other than Debbie, whose barbecue Cam is supposed to attend in less than 2 hours, come to think of it, that might have been her calling just now. Standing over the sink, she squeezes a gob of Crest onto her toothbrush. Or it could have been the detective. But when she checks for messages, there aren't any. Couldn't reach your friend? Hanging up the telephone receiver in the parlor, Lucinda looks up to see Martha, the inn's owner, watching her from the doorway with a plastic laundry basket in her arms. Oh, no. No answer. She moves away from the phone, almost tripping over a stack of magazines in a fake antique box that reads, Firewood. More clutter. Lucinda, who happens to be something of a pack rat herself, has never seen so much of it in her life. Most people have answering machines these days. He doesn't. Well aware Martha is fishing with that strategic he, Lucinda asks, Who doesn't have an answering machine? Your friend. The person you called. He's not a he, and she does have voicemail, which Lucinda just hung up on. But she isn't about to tell the old snoop any of that. Do you know what time it is? She asks instead. She forgot her watch upstairs when she went for a walk on the beach just now, thinking she should sort things out in her head. Martha gestures at the mantel clock. 12:15. Lucinda thanks her, then heads into the foyer. She peruses the stack of daily and weekly newspapers on the table. Only one that's missing is the New York Times. She looks up to see that Martha has followed her. That woman who's staying in the cottage out back took it to breakfast with her, and then it disappeared. So did she. Kathy, the woman Lucinda met yesterday morning, the one she was so certain was hiding something. She didn't figure out what it was, though, and Kathy beat a hasty retreat. She hasn't seen her since. She wishes Martha would make herself scarce as well, but here she is, making small talk about the weather. Lucinda should never have asked her to use the guest house telephone in the first place, but she didn't want to place the call from her cell. She never likes to give it out when she's working on a case, or ever, for that matter. Handing her phone number to a stranger opens the door to all kinds of potential trouble. Prank calls, desperate requests from the bereaved, fortune-teller buffs wanting their palms read. Lucinda learned the hard way that it's best for her to be reachable only through Neil. He's her liaison to the general public, and he's not here with her. So, end of story. Except this is different. Randy is involved, and Camden Hastings isn't exactly the general public, and she isn't seeking psychic feedback. She's a psychic herself. So why didn't you give her your number last night? Habit, she supposes. Then why are you so determined that she doesn't get it even now? What have you got planned for today? Martha asks conversationally. Going to the beach? Having momentarily forgotten all about her, Lucinda glances her way and finds her still hovering. Ignoring the question, she poses one of her own. What time is checkout? Checkout? You mean for tomorrow? It's noon. No, I mean for today. Today? It's too late. It's 12:00 already, remember? And you said you were staying until... I need to leave today, Lucinda says abruptly. Martha's straggly white brows furrow. I'm afraid you can't do that. There's a 3-night minimum on holiday weekends. This is the first Lucinda's heard about that, but she shrugs. Sorry, she says. I can't stay. But I'd have to charge you for... Go ahead. Just bill it to my credit card. Martha scowls, then heads for the stairs with her laundry basket. Lucinda waits a few minutes, flipping through the papers, not wanting to follow her right up. Yeah, it's time to go, definitely. The place is a dump, and she's made no progress with the Roby case, and Randy went and married Carla. Why stick around? An image of Cam Hastings pops into her head. Yeah. And now that Lucinda has figured out what the vision means, she has all the more reason to avoid Cam, right? Right. Or maybe she has all the more reason to confront her with a warning, which is what she was thinking when she tried calling her just now. But when Cam didn't pick up, she talked herself right back out of it. What's wrong with you? This isn't like you, bullshitting around, wondering what to do. She knows what to do. Didn't she learn the hard way, years ago, what can happen when you try to warn a person that something horrible is going to happen to a loved one? But Cam isn't just some random person. She understands about premonitions, has them herself. All the more reason to approach her. Lucinda turns away from the newspapers and heads for the stairs. So, say you do tell her that her daughter is in danger. What's she supposed to do about it? You don't know where, or how, or when it's going to happen. For all you know, it already has. And now you're making no sense whatsoever. All Lucinda knows is that she saw a girl, whom she now understands is Cam's daughter, engaged in a futile struggle with a man in some kind of dark hood. Just a snippet of a scene, but the outcome is going to be violent. She didn't see that part, but she could feel it. And death, looming, ready to pounce. She's felt it before. She's never been wrong, never once. So what would warning Cam accomplish? She'd be beside herself with anxiety. Any mother would be. For a pregnant woman, at her age especially, that wouldn't be good. In the end, it will change nothing. If her daughter is destined to die, and she is, then she will. So I won't tell her mother, Lucinda decides. I can't save the world. I just do what I can. Same as always. Her cell phone rings in her pocket as she reaches the second floor hallway. She pauses to answer it before starting up the next flight to the hotter-than-Hades third floor. There's no sign of Martha. She's probably upstairs stripping Lucinda's bed for the next unwitting sap who comes along. Hello? It's Randy. What are you doing? I'm about to pack and head back to Philly. A pause. Then, you might want to rethink that plan. Why? She asks again. Because a girl named Rebecca Pearson disappeared from her bedroom at her family's summer house in Lovelady sometime overnight. Lucinda sucks in a breath. Let me guess. 13 years old, red hair, freckles. Yeah, and she was wearing a necklace. I'll guess again. Shark's tooth on a silver chain? Exactly. Her sister said she got it from a secret admirer. I'll just bet she did. As Lucinda shakes her head, clutching the phone, she hears a faint sound, a creaking floorboard. Someone is lurking, concealed somewhere nearby, listening. Coming with me to talk to the family? Randy asks. Wary, Lucinda answers with one word. Definitely. Good. Get right over here, then. And I wouldn't check out yet if I were you.
I already did.
Check back in.
I doubt that's possible.
She casts a glance down the hall. Still no sign of Martha or a fellow guest. I'll try to find you another place, then. Worst comes to worst, you can stay in our guest room.
His and Carla's guest room?
That would be worse, comes to no way in hell. She'd sooner come crawling back to this pit than set foot inside their happy abode and come face to face with the woman who put that gold ring on Randy's finger.
I'll work something out, she assures him.
Tess stares out the car window at the green landscape lining the Garden State Parkway, wondering what her mother's going to say when she walks in the door. She, or her father, should probably have called to say she was coming back early. But pretty much the moment she told Dad she wanted to leave, after they both slept in until well past 10, he started packing. Not in anger or hurt. No, he seemed more resigned. As if he's simply given up on Tess. Which isn't the best feeling. He had the car loaded before breakfast, and they were in it less than half an hour later, heading north. The trip was a repeat performance of the one down to D.C. the day before yesterday. Slow going, holiday traffic, Dad brooding, Tess plugged into her iPod. A few times, overcome by guilt, she almost told him to turn around and go back. But she managed not to. She doesn't want to go back to Washington with him. She doesn't want to be on Long Beach Island without him, either. The whole thing sucks. Tess sighs, seeing the sign for Route 72, the exit leading to the island causeway. Dad must have seen it too. She hears the rumble of his voice above the throbbing bass in her ear and realizes he's saying something to her. She unplugs one earphone.
What?
What if your mother's not home?
She will be.
How do you know? You should call her and make sure.
It's not a big deal if she's not there. It's not like she's gone for the weekend. She'll show up eventually. You can wait with me until she does.
Tess waits a minute for him to respond, but he says nothing. With a shrug, she plugs her earphone in again and goes back to staring out the window and hating her life.
Pop?
Shocked, Cam stares at her father, who just materialized on her threshold in a white wife beater, cutoffs, and flip-flops, a red bandana tied over his straggly gray hair, do-rag style.
Happy 4th of July.
He hands her a cardboard and cellophane box. She looks down to see supermarket donut holes, glazed, with red, white, and blue sprinkles.
It is the 4th of July, right?
Ike asks.
Right.
I really need to get a calendar one of these days, among other things.
Cam reaches across the threshold and gives him a hug.
Come in. What are you doing here?
You said to come visit. I found myself on the island, so here I am.
Drunk as a skunk, too. She finds herself enveloped in liquor fumes and other unsavory scents, and her stomach churns a little.
Where's my grandbaby?
Tess? She's out with Mike.
Cam will have to tell him the truth, but it won't sink in unless she sobers him up first. He could use a good scrubbing, too, she decides, wrinkling her nose as she closes the door behind him.
It's so hot and sticky out. Why don't you go take a nice cool shower? She asks.
I'll throw your clothes into the washer for you and find something else for you to wear.
God knows what.
Mike left a few things behind in a drawer last August when they closed up the house. They all did, as usual, wanting to think they might prolong summer by making another weekend trip to the island sometime in the fall. They never have.
When it's over, Cam thinks grimly.
Like everything else in life, apparently.
I reek, don't I?
Her father asks as she leads the way to the bathroom.
A little. But I love you anyway. Where have you been hiding?
Who says I've been hiding?
He sounds prickly. He can be a nasty drunk on occasion, though he's usually pretty jovial.
It's just an expression, she says shortly. Towels are in that cabinet. I'll go make some coffee.
I'd rather have a beer.
Fresh out, sorry.
Cam leaves him in the bathroom, shaking her head. In the living room, where the shades are still pulled down, the marble notebooks sit on the table beside the empty water glass from last night. Talk about careless. She has to put those away. Not that Ike is likely to go snooping around, or would be capable of reading, in his current condition, if he wanted to. Heading for the kitchen, she decides she'll start the coffee first, then put the notebooks back in the closet. Of all the things she didn't need today, an unexpected visit from her father was at the top of the list. Well, it could have been worse. It could have been Mike, popping up unexpectedly on her doorstep to pick up where they left off. Luckily for Cam, he and Tess are 200 miles away right about now. Pop is going to ask about them. She'll have to tell him. She's measuring coffee grounds into a filter basket when her cell phone rings somewhere in the bedroom. This time, she reaches it before it goes to voicemail. Again, it's a local number.
Camden Hastings?
Yes?
Detective Barricat.
With a sinking feeling, she knows, before he says anything else, what he's going to tell her. And she's right.
Rebecca Pearson,
she echoes, when he tells her the name of the girl who vanished in the dead of night.
I'm on my way now to speak with her parents.
Cam, now in the kitchen, stares miserably out the kitchen window at the beach house across the way, thinking of Rebecca's mother.
Listen, I know you're not used to this kind of thing,
the detective goes on. But if you'd like to come over there with me.
No, she says quickly. No, I can't.
I thought you might see something else. If you had a chance to see her room, touch her things, meet her parents. That's how it works with Lucinda.
It doesn't work that way with me.
How do you know? Have you ever tried?
No, but...
You've never run into one of these victims in person before, either. But you did with Rebecca Pearson. Cam hesitates, thinking again of Rebecca's mother. The woman must be distraught.
All right, she says slowly. Maybe if she's being held someplace, I can get some kind of psychic impression of where she is, especially if she's nearby.
Okay, I'll come pick you up and bring you over there.
When?
Now would be good. She agrees to meet him out in front of her house, then hangs up.
Camden?
The voice scares the hell out of Cam, and she gasps, whirling around.
What's wrong? Did you forget I was here?
Asks her father, standing in the doorway, towel in hand.
Oh, actually I did, she admits, and sinks into a chair, trembling.
She wonders how long he's been standing there, eavesdropping.
I wanted to ask if you had a disposable razor so I can shave before I get into the shower. I caught sight of myself in the mirror and thought I was looking at Santa Claus.
There's a razor in the drawer on the right, beneath the sink, she tells him, and forces herself to get up again, keep talking. Listen, I've got to go out and run a few errands. Take your shower, have some coffee. Take a nap. I'll be back a little later and we'll catch up then, okay?
Ike shrugs.
Why not?
As he makes his way back to the bathroom, Cam, exhausted, rakes a hand through her hair and looks down at her swollen midsection.
I'm so sorry, she whispers, laying a gentle hand over her stomach. As if in reply, something, a tiny foot or fist, flutters within. The baby's first kick.
Hastily wiping a blur of tears, Cam heads for the door. Not only is Cam's Volvo in the driveway, but Mike also sees his father-in-law's car parked at the curb.
Looks like Granddad's here, he tells Tess.
In the passenger seat, she's finally pulled the earplugs out and is shoving her bare feet into her flip-flops.
Good. We haven't seen him in, like, forever. Not since winter.
Winter. Before Mike left. He's not particularly eager to face his father-in-law. Ike can be an easygoing guy, but he does have a temper. He can't be happy about the separation. Or his daughter now alone and pregnant, his granddaughter in a broken home. That makes all of us, Mike thinks glumly. He's had a lot of time to think things through on the drive back. He's going to be a father again. Another tiny miracle in his arms. Another chance. Maybe he and Cam really should try again to make things work. For the baby's sake. And Tess's. And who is he kidding? For their own.
Yeah.
He needs to talk to Cam as soon as possible. If Tess hadn't asked to go home today, he might have suggested it himself. The street is lined with more cars than usual.
Looks like someone's having a party, Mike comments as he pulls in behind the Volvo.
Yeah, friends of ours are.
Tess's hand is already on the door handle.
A few houses down. Mom's there, I'm sure.
Friends of theirs, not his. Strange that his wife and daughter have friends he's never met, go to parties to which he isn't invited. This can't go on. It's strange and it's wrong, and things are going to get back to the way they were. Granted, the way things were wasn't so great either, but Mike is going to make things better. He's going to work at his marriage, try hard to get it right. What if Cam doesn't want to, though? Yeah, she's stopped drinking, but that doesn't mean she'll be the same old Cam. She might let you back into the house, but that doesn't mean she'll let you in. Mike pushes aside the nagging memory of Cam's emotional fortress
and opens his car door. "What are you doing?" Tess asks promptly.
"Coming in to talk to your mother."
"I just told you, she's probably at the party."
"Maybe not. Granddad's here."
Mike nods. For all he knows, Cam is down the street with her new friends, and Ike is inside, passed out cold in front of an empty six-pack. The scene isn't exactly set for a romantic reunion. Maybe he should wait, figure out how to get it right. But then he heads for Japan in about a week, and by the time he gets back, the summer will be half over.
"You can leave, Dad," Tess says. "I'll go find Mom and tell her I'm back."
"You don't think she might wonder why you're home 2 days early and want to talk to me?"
"You don't think I'm capable of explaining it to her?" she shoots back.
He fixes Tess with a look, wondering how exactly she would spin their early departure from D.C. without his input. But that's beside the point.
"There are some things I need to discuss with your mom, Tess."
"Oh, yeah. You mean the bag search thing? Because you don't necessarily need to talk to her about that in person. And anyway," Tess goes on, "I'm telling her my side of the story either way. She'll believe me."
"Yeah. Well, so do I."
"What?" Tess gapes.
"I said I believe you."
"You do?"
"I've been thinking about it, and I realized you've never lied to me before."
"No," she shakes her head. "I told you, I never did."
"So I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. I know what it's like to try to fit in with friends at your age, although you do know that taking a bottle of vodka from that girl was wrong, don't you?"
Tess nods vigorously.
"I wasn't going to drink it. I just didn't want her to think I was a baby."
"But you've learned your lesson, right? Because if I ever catch you with booze again, or with anything that—"
"Dad, you won't. Do you think I'm actually going to drink after seeing what it did to Mom?"
He's silent for a moment. "No, I really don't. But there are other things, Tess. Things kids will want you to do."
"And you don't trust me to be smart enough not to?"
"Sometimes it's not about being smart." Mike shakes his head. "She's got so much to learn at this age. So many hard choices ahead. She's going to be a big sister, a role model for someone who's going to grow up looking up to her. And I want to be there to teach her, guide her, watch over her. One step at a time, Mike." "The thing is," he says, "I believe you. I believe that you were worried about your mother, and you didn't want her to start drinking again, so you took that bottle with you when you left."
"She got rid of everything. I thought if she found that vodka, she might start again."
"She's stronger than you think, Tess," he says quietly.
"Yeah, maybe she is. So anyway, are you going back now?"
Tess asks, obviously eager to join Cam at the party with all those people who are a part of their life on the island, which he is not.
"No," Mike gets out of the car. "I'm staying here."
Tess's eyes widen.
"For good?"
"I wish." "No, just I want to talk to Mom. Let's go in."
Nina, Lucinda turns to the missing girl's younger sister, a shell-shocked 12-year-old with the same red hair and freckles. "Did your sister mention how that shark's tooth necklace got to her? Was it mailed, or—" Nina shakes her head.
"She found it in a bag hanging on her bike handlebars the other morning."
"Where was her bike?"
"Parked under the overhang by the patio. That's where we keep all our bikes. Mine, Becca's, Mom's, Dad's."
"So someone must have known which bike was your sister's." That question comes from Randy.
"I guess."
Nina looks down at her white keds.
"Was it obvious?" Randy asks.
"He means," Lucinda says, "was Rebecca's name on it or something?"
"No, and mine and Nina's are just like hers, only different colors,"
Rebecca's mother, Diane, says thinly. Rebecca's was pink.
It's her favorite color, Nina adds, and her mother nods.
We always tease her about it because it clashes with her hair.
Diane makes a sound that starts out as a laugh, but winds up a sob. Her husband, Bob, puts an arm around her and the other around Nina as she too begins to cry.
This is brutal.
Lucinda glances at Cam to see how she's handling this. Seated in the chair closest to the door, she looks as though she wishes she could run right through it. Lucinda tries to catch her eye, wanting to offer an encouraging smile, though she's not sure why. There's nothing encouraging about the scene at the Pearsons' house, a modern three-level oceanfront property in Loveladies. The forensics team is still working in Rebecca's bedroom, so the rest of them are here in the living room on the top floor. The three Pearsons are on the couch, with Lucinda and Randy flanking them in comfortable chairs. Lucinda figures they assume she and Cam are also detectives. They were too distraught to ask any questions when Randy introduced the two of them by name only.
We know how hard this is for all of you. Randy's voice is laced with concern and compassion. I know you've been over this a few times already, Mr. Pearson, but you were the last one to see your daughter last night. Would you mind telling me everything you remember again?
He's not a suspect, is he?
Rebecca's mother asks, sounding alarmed.
The parents are always suspects, Diane, her husband responds. But it's okay. I'll tell you anything you want to know.
Restless as Bob goes over the details again, Lucinda rises from her chair and paces across the room. Glancing out at the blue patch of sea in the distance, she sees something flash in her mind's eye. A dorsal fin. It rises out of the water, just like before, that day in Leah Roby's bedroom. But this time, there are more fins, and churning water, bubbling red with blood. If Lucinda was holding out any hope for Rebecca Pearson, in that instant, it evaporates. She knows without a doubt that the girl was murdered, her remains disposed of at sea. Shaking her head in sorrow, she turns abruptly away from the window and finds Cam staring at her. She knows, Lucinda realizes, seeing her bleak expression. She feels it too. She shakes her head slightly at Cam and tilts it toward the family on the couch. Cam shakes her head back. No, she won't say a word to them about it either.
We're going to put out an Amber Alert, Randy is telling the Pearsons, and we're pulling in all our resources to find her as quickly as possible.
Without anything concrete to go on, it's better to let them stay in the dark for now. Just as it's best to do the same for Cam herself.
Chapter 14.
So, what's doing?
Granddad asks as the three of them, he, Tess, and Dad, sit down at the kitchen table together. Granddad and Dad are having coffee. Tess, a couple of glazed donut holes her grandfather had brought.
Not much, Dad says. Washington was hot, crowded. That's why we left early.
Not really, but Tess nods, grateful to go with that explanation.
Washington?
Her grandfather looks from Dad to Tess and back again, apparently confused. That's not surprising. He seemed a little out of it when they came in, and Tess could smell booze on his breath. Maybe he's drunk. It wouldn't be the first time. Like daughter, like father.
Who was in Washington?
Granddad asks Dad.
We were. We just got back.
Granddad looks around.
Cam, too?
Cam is here in Beach Haven. You just said you saw her, remember? Dad sounds a little anxious.
You said she went out to do some errands.
Which doesn't make sense, Tess thinks, because Mom's car is here. She must be down at Debbie's. Granddad must be confused.
I thought that's what she said,
Granddad says, frowning.
I thought I saw her, but now you're saying you were all in Washington.
Just me and Tess.
Not Cam?
No.
Good. I was hoping I wasn't seeing things. I could have sworn I'd talked to her.
Granddad sips his coffee, makes a face. Then he looks up sharply.
Why didn't she go with you?
Now Dad looks uncomfortable.
She had other, things to do this weekend.
Like what?
Tess decides to get things out into the open.
He doesn't know, she tells her father, about you and Mom.
Obviously not, Dad mutters and shoots her a dark look.
To Granddad, he says only,
why don't we all discuss this together when Cam gets back?
Discuss what?
Mom and Dad are separated, Granddad, Tess says. At her father's dismayed expression, she asks innocently,
what?
He shakes his head.
I'm just being honest, Dad. You always said that was the best policy, remember? And I always tell the truth. Always.
The last word is pointed.
You and Cam are separated?
Granddad sounds sad. Yeah, Ike, I didn't realize you didn't know. I didn't want to be the one who told you.
What the hell happened?
I wish I knew. Tess looks at her father in surprise, just as a knock sounds on the door.
I'll get that.
She seizes the opportunity to hurry out of the room. Beth is standing on the other side of the screen door.
Hey, what are you doing here? I thought you were in Washington.
I was. What are you doing here?
My mom sent me over to get your mom for the barbecue.
She's not there?
Nope. It started a while ago. Mom's been trying to call for like an hour, but she must have her cell phone turned off. Where is she?
I don't know. Errands, I guess. Tess frowns. What kind of errands would Mom run without her car?
She supposes someone could have picked her up. But who?
Remembering her old passing suspicion, back when they were at home and Dad first left, she wonders if her mother is out with another man.
That has to be it. Mom was cheating. That's why Dad left, after all.
Come on, Beth says and holds the door open.
Come on where?
Tess is reeling.
To the barbecue. Your mom can meet us there.
I can't go.
Why not?
My grandfather's here, and my dad still is, too, so...
So?
So I can't just abandon them.
Beth shrugs.
Bring them, whatever. You have to come. I need you.
Why?
Tess asks, pleased, nonetheless, to be needed by Beth.
Because you've got to meet this lady my mother hired to stay with us when she goes back to work. Dolores.
She's there?
Yeah, I hate her already.
What did she do?
She's just evil.
I can tell.
Beth frowns, then, just as quickly, shifts gears with an excited,
oh, listen, you have got to hear who I met on the beach today. I was gonna text you about it.
Who?
Guess. You'll never believe it.
Bruce Springsteen?
Bruce Springsteen? Beth rolls her eyes.
You said I would never believe it.
Why wouldn't you? He hangs out down here all the time. He's from Freehold or something. But anyway, no. I mean someone good.
Bruce is good.
Please.
Obviously, Beth doesn't agree.
I don't know, Tess says impatiently.
Who?
Someone from back home.
Where do you live again?
Not my home, you goof. Yours. Someone you know.
Who? Tess asks again, trepidation creeping in.
This hottie lifeguard?
Who?
Tess practically screams it this time.
His name is Heath.
How are you doing? You still okay?
Randall Barakat asks Cam as the three of them step over the threshold into Rebecca Pearson's bedroom on the first floor.
Hanging in there.
She tries to smile at him, but can't quite muster one.
Rebecca is never coming back here.
She's dead. The impression washed over her as they sat upstairs talking to her parents and sister, all of them clinging to the hope that Rebecca ran away, even though that's not like her. Mr. Pearson even speculated that she's being held for ransom somewhere and told Randy that he's willing to pay to get her back.
Do me a favor, Randy said in response. Don't say that to anyone other than me, okay? There are a lot of nutcases in the world.
Yes,
and one of them stole Bob and Diane Pearson's daughter in the night and killed her. Cam can't put her finger on exactly how she knows it, but she does. So does Lucinda. She can tell. Still, Lucinda walks around the bedroom, now covered in fingerprint dust and little tent markers that indicate possible evidence locations. There were no signs of a break-in, Randy comments in a low voice. And we don't think anyone came and took her out of this room, no matter what her parents claim. She wouldn't sneak out of the house late at night. Not there, little girl. Lucinda murmurs with a nod, as though she's heard it all before. I'd say the same thing about Tess, Cam realizes. Not my little girl. Only Tess isn't a little girl anymore. Still, she would never. The dizziness blows in out of nowhere, and Cam blindly grabs the door jamb. Images flash in and out of her head, a bizarre slideshow at warp speed. Tess, terrified, with a tear-stained face. Tess, panting, staring wide-eyed at something, someone Cam can't see. Tess pleading, Tess in danger, Tess afraid. Tess unable to breathe, strangling, throat constricted, lungs bursting. Cam, are you all right? Dazed, she looks up to see both Randy and Lucinda, concerned. It looks like you're hyperventilating. Lucinda touches her shoulder. Do you want a paper bag or... Hyperventilating? It was Tess. Tess can't breathe.
No, Cam says weakly. I really need to get out of here.
Please. Under the boardwalk, boardwalk, Ike sings along with the drifters, lounging on a plastic chaise on someone's deck in the sunshine. He doesn't know whose deck, just some neighbor of his daughter's. Who cares whose deck it is? Ike was invited, and he's here. Someone hands him another cold beer. He drains the old bottle quickly and lifts the new in a toast.
Thanks, buddy.
You're welcome, whoever it is says cheerfully and reaches into one of the ice-filled coolers again. Great party. He doesn't know a soul here besides Tess, who disappeared a few minutes after she and Ike arrived. But again, who cares? A deck barbecue on a beautiful July day on the island? Yeah, he'll take it. Someone's cooking burgers and hot dogs on a grill. The music is cranking over a couple of decent speakers. There's a lot of beer, good beer, imported in long-neck bottles, and frozen piña coladas. The pretty little brunette poured him one when he first got here. She laughed when he drained it in one big gulp, gave a satisfied, ah, and plunked the cup down to be refilled again.
You're Cam's dad? She asked, obliging.
Yep. And you are?
Debbie, he thinks she said, though he could be wrong. He's met so many people in the last hour. Or is it two?
I'll have Dolores go make another pitcher. Dolores?
That name Ike remembers. He knew a Dolores once, years ago, down here at the shore. Can it possibly be her? How many Doloreses can there be? She's my hired woman. He can't imagine his Dolores being a hired woman. Anyway, what are the odds he'd run into her here, on his daughter's street? That would be a huge coincidence, that's for damn sure. If you need another refill, Cam's friend said, just go into the kitchen and Dolores will set you up. Ike didn't bother. Beer is fine with him. He's not one of those fancy types who likes girl drinks, like the ones at the sand bucket. Too bad Cam's not around. She should be showing up sooner or later, though, right? He left her a note. Or maybe it was Tess who wrote the note. He can't remember exactly. It wasn't Mike, though. Mike, he's pretty sure, left to drive back to the city. Alone. Ike may actually have told him to get the hell out of his daughter's house. Or life. Or maybe he just wanted to say it, but kept the words to himself. The details are a little fuzzy now. He's certain of one thing, though. Mike and Cam split up months ago, and no one told him till today. And he's mad as hell. Don't they know you don't just give up and walk away? Way to ruin a great day. Only Ike's not going to let it.
On a blanket with my baby is where I'll be, he sings, and guzzles some beer. My baby.
Excuse me? Ike looks up into the sun to see Ava standing over him. His jaw drops. He blinks. Turns his head a little. The light shifts. She moves her head.
Oh, it's not Ava.
The woman looks nothing like Ava, in fact.
You were just looking for her, same as always. For her, for Brenda, for Cam, your girls.
Are you Camden Hastings, Dad?
The woman asks, all friendly. Sure am. Who are you?
I'm a friend of hers. I heard she's involved in that missing persons case.
Ike's heart stops beating. The drifters stop singing. The world stops turning.
Missing?
Ike puts his hand back to prop himself straight. His fist goes through the plastic slats.
Cam is missing?
No, she's not missing. She's helping. On the case. Right?
His heart beats. The drifters sing. The world turns. He leans back again.
Jesus.
She's some kind of witness or something, I heard. Someone said she was working with the cops.
Cops? Witness? Cam?
Ike decides that either the woman's stoned out of her mind, or he is, though he doesn't remember getting high. But that's nothing new.
I have no idea what you're talking about, he says pleasantly. She doesn't tell her old man everything, you know.
Come to think of it, she doesn't tell him much of anything at all.
So, Randy looks at Lucinda over the rim of his coffee cup.
So,
she's dead, isn't she?
Lucinda sips her own coffee, sets it down.
Did I say that?
You didn't have to. I figured it out.
You're psychic?
No, but you are, and I can read you, Sloan, like a book.
Don't be so sure.
You're telling me the Pearson girl's not dead?
I didn't say that.
But trust me, I'm not an open book. Trust me, I know that.
They look at each other for a few seconds. Randy is the first to shift his gaze. He gestures with his laminated one-page menu.
Know what you want?
Just coffee.
Just coffee? What happened to the famous Lucinda Sloan appetite?
I lost it, she says, folding her arms across her stomach. Right about the time I realized that poor girl was fed to the sharks.
Randy sets aside his menu and leans forward.
You're serious?
Pretty much.
Was she alive? Before? During?
No, she says quickly, and shudders. It was her body.
Being eaten by sharks?
That's what I saw.
Was it symbolic? He asks thoughtfully. You know, because of the necklace she had on. And Leah Roby, too?
She's been asking herself that very question.
I don't think so.
There's a difference, a subtle one, between visions that are meant to be interpreted symbolically and scenes that depict actual happenings. This, Lucinda is pretty certain, was the latter. It was so vivid, gruesomely vivid.
You think that's what Cam saw, too, when she got upset there in the room at the end? Randy asks.
I have no idea. She didn't say.
Back at the Pearson home, they sent a pale, shaken Cam off in a police cruiser with two officers who promised to see her safely home.
Did you see the look on her face when she said she had to go? She must have seen something.
She's not used to this, Lucinda says. It was hard on her.
It's got to be hard on you, too.
Randy reaches out and touches her hand. She pulls it away like she's just been branded.
Me? I'm used to it. I'm fine.
She can feel him nod, can feel his eyes on her from across the table, but she doesn't dare look at him. Why did she agree to join him at this coffee shop after leaving the Pearsons? They should have just gone their separate ways. The waitress arrives. She's been hovering. Plenty of time on her hands.
No one wants to hang around inside a greasy spoon on a day like today. Randy orders a turkey club, cheeseburger, fries, iced tea, chocolate shake. Hearing his order, Lucinda rediscovers her appetite. She's drained, depressed, hungry. But she told him she wasn't. And anyway, if she doesn't order anything, she can just finish her coffee and go. Somewhere. Turkey club and cheeseburger? Lucinda asks when the waitress walks away. Cheeseburger's for you. She raises an eyebrow. So's the shake. You didn't by any chance see who fed her to the sharks? Randy asks, back on the case.
No, I didn't see much of anything.
Just the sharks.
And the water.
Blood. She shudders again. So you're saying a body's not going to wash up at Surf City or somewhere a few weeks from now and scare people away from the beaches?
Randy, for God's sake.
Lucinda, I'm trying to get a handle on what you're telling me. This girl vanishes less than 24 hours ago, and she's
never coming back, Randy.
She's never going to wash up on a beach either. Some people might say never.
I'm not one of them.
Yeah, no kidding. Lucinda Sloan frequently says never. Means it, too. Like when she told Randy to get out of her life, never come back.
She meant it.
He listened. Are you going to stay in our guest room tonight? He asks, resting his chin on his hand and looking across the table at her.
Don't you think that would be a little awkward?
For who? Carla doesn't know.
For you, for me.
That's better than saying for us. There is no us. Hasn't been in years. I wouldn't feel awkward at all, Randy informs her, a little too casually. So unless you would, she would. Before she can tell him that, he goes on, obviously remembering what she told him about the unpleasant guest house experience. Listen, we've got plenty of room, air conditioning, and great coffee. What do you say?
I say I can't.
You can. You're more than welcome.
Thanks, but no thanks. I'm going to eat a cheeseburger, drink a shake, and head back home.
All the way to Philly?
Where else?
She leans back, relieved. It's the right thing to do. The hardest thing is always the right thing to do. Didn't she figure that out when she was just a little girl? So you're just going to blow out of here and leave me hanging in the middle of a case? Randy's expression is laced with regret.
Regret because of the case? Regret because she's leaving? What does it matter? She's leaving. Her mind is made up.
The waitress refills Randy's coffee. Lucinda puts a hand over her own cup and shakes her head.
Look, I'm sorry, she says when the waitress leaves. I've done what I can. I've told you what you need to know.
No, she hasn't told Rebecca Pearson's family. Guilt washes over her. Same old story. How can she tell them? What would she say? Your daughter is dead? No, I don't have any proof. How do I know? Because I'm a psychic. You'll just have to take my word for it. Give up hope. She can't give closure to the Pearson family. Not now, anyway. Randy is still looking at her, still waiting.
For what?
She exhales through puffed cheeks.
What more do you want from me?
Why would I stay? I'm not a cop, Randy, or a detective, or... I know. So I don't have to see this thing through for months on end, looking for clues, tracking false leads. That's not up to me. No, I know, I get it. He trails off. Plunking a spoon into his coffee, he stirs it hard, though he takes it black and unsweetened.
You just what, Randy? She wants to press.
It would be so easy to get him to go there. To go there herself. So easy to fall right back into it. And so damn wrong.
See? I told you. That's him, right?
Gazing across the beach at the white wooden lifeguard stand, Tess nods.
Yeah, she tells Beth. That's him.
High on his perch, Heath Pickering faces the water, twirling a whistle on a string.
"What did he say about me again?"
she asks, plunking herself down in the sand, thoughts whirling. Dismay over her mother's affair is on hold for the time being. Heath Pickering's presence on the island has eclipsed all that.
"I already told you what he said." "Tell me again, please."
Beth sits beside her.
"It wasn't much. When Jared introduced me to him,"
Jared is another lifeguard, Beth's latest crush,
"he asked where I was from, you know, and then I asked where he was from, and he said he used to live in California, but now he lives in Montclair. And I did the whole, 'Montclair, my friend lives there too, do you know her?' And he was like, 'Yeah, I know her.'"
"That's it. That's all he said?"
"What he said was, 'I know her, but not that well.' And that was pretty much it."
"Pretty much?"
"Tess, that was it."
Beth shakes her head, her sleek black hair swinging across her bare shoulders. She's wearing a bikini top and cutoffs. Tess is too, but of course, she looks a lot different in hers. She wonders what he thought of Beth when he met her.
"Look, it's time for his break."
Beth points to the stand, where another lifeguard is ascending and Heath is waiting to come down.
"So should we go talk to him?"
Beth starts to get up.
"No."
Tess grabs her arm, pulls her back down.
"Why not? I thought you liked him."
Like doesn't even begin to cover it. Just hearing his name mentioned earlier, for the first time in weeks, brought back a lot of old feelings. Not just, to Tess's surprise, the familiar